This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 52nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Paul Kotcher. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me here.
Paul Kotcher is president and chief scientist of cryptography research. A successful entrepreneur, Paul has gained an international reputation for his research and innovative technical design in cryptography. His accomplishments are many and include helping to design SSL3, discovering differential power analysis, designing EFF's Deep Crack DES key search machine, and designing parts of the security system for content protection in Blu-ray. Paul continues to design crypto protocols and applications, which are successfully deployed in real-world systems. Before founding Cryptography Research, Paul worked at RSA Security and helped found the company that became Tumbleweed. Paul has a BS in biology from Stanford. He was elected to the National Academy of Engineering in 2009, and he lives in San Francisco with his wife, Helene. Together, they are getting ready to discover that children scale exponentially. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Gary.
It's clear to me that you are a very hands-on kind of a guy, as opposed to a book-learned theoretician. And so the first question is, when you were a kid, what was the first system that you broke to your advantage?
Well, I'm trying to think. Cheating in video games was actually one of the things that got me interested in security, although that was back in the days of the sort of single-player game where you'd get a game and then they'd have you do some monotonous, repetitive task for many, many hours in order to progress to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
These weren't the sort of online games where there are all sorts of ethical issues with cheating. It's purely a question of whether you can save your time doing this sort of repetitive task.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days of computers, though, things were so unreliable and so flaky that when things didn't work right, you'd get frustrated with it and you'd go in and you'd change the way things were functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So the line between user and, in the positive sense of the word, hacker, was drawn very differently. And
yeah.
Especially if you learned the way I did, which is my dad brought equipment home from his lab occasionally and didn't bring any manuals, and I just sort of figured out how the stuff worked. I ended up learning things from a very low-level upward direction, which is the opposite from the way most computer science is taught, where first you work with, you know, pretty GUIs, and then you gradually go down, and maybe someday, many years later, you see assembly language.
if ever.
So, right, which means I'm the last person in the world you want to have designing a user interface, but if you're working at low-level guts of systems, like how do you build the chip so that it's secure, those sorts of questions you really have to focus from the low level and look at the implications going upward.
Uh-huh. How about hardware hacking or toy hacking or anything like that?
I tend to break things and then put them together again. So again, that and any time you get a device that doesn't do what you want, I'm somebody who wants to go in and fix it. Unfortunately, these days I don't have as much time to do that sort of thing as I'd like to, because I have to, you know, manage people and this kind of thing. I've never been somebody who is really into the, you know, temptation to hack things in sort of a malicious way.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of a line there which I don't try to. I try to stay as far away from as possible.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an admirable point of view. So security analysis benefits from both a big picture system level view of a target and an understanding of how various levels and layers in a system interact. Is this analysis capability something that you think can be taught?
It certainly can be learned. I think with any kind of an art, whether it be cryptography or painting, you have to like what you're doing, and you can't learn it by just being forced to sit through half a dozen classes and be done. It's got to be one of these things that you know, live and breathe, and when you're trying to fall asleep at night, it's going through your head, sort of percolating your membranes as you try to figure out what the issues are. And anybody who's got that enthusiasm, I think, can learn this, at least assuming you have some math aptitude. You mentioned something interesting about layers, though, and it's probably worth talking about that a little more, and that at least in my view, the way that layers in a system and layers of abstraction work with security applications is completely different from traditional applications, because layers hide problems and in many ways are the thing that we're trying to cope with, whereas in other areas, you know, if you can abstract a problem, great. You don't have to worry about what sits underneath.
Mm-hmm.
With security, you have to worry about every single thing underneath you in the stack, all the way down to the transistors. And if you forget something or screw something up, you're likely to have a catastrophic problem.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good stomping ground for potential attack to think about those layers and think about the assumptions in particular that a higher layer may make, which you can make go away as an attacker.
Absolutely. And if you want to find vulnerabilities, you'll almost never find them sitting at a single layer or in a single piece designed by one person. It's where things interact across those layers that you get all the really interesting results.
So my opinion has changed over the years regarding whether or not engineers and architects of systems need to be taught to think like a bad guy. What's your opinion?
I think what you need to do to be a good architect involves thinking differently from a bad guy, because the bad guy is a hero if he finds one way in, whereas the defender is a complete. So if you have a 1% success rate as an attacker, you're tremendously successful. But if you're a defender and you have a 99.9% success rate at building components that work together and you've got thousands of components in your system, you're a complete failure because your systems are going to have vulnerabilities. Or if 1% of the attacks succeed against your system, you're a complete failure. So you have to be able to think much more comprehensively, much more completely as a defender. That said, there are certain things like understanding how attackers will find one little chink in the armor and then use that to find another and build a series of different steps to get through a defense that otherwise looks pretty strong. You've really got to understand. So I think the attackers need to understand that way of thinking, but you've got to be able to do more than that.
Mm-hmm. That's a,
is that your opinion?
Pretty much. I mean, I used to believe that all system designers and developers and architects needed to know something about attacks. And in fact, I thought they needed to know a lot about attacks. But I think in some sense, the skill of building things defensively is equally important. And if you teach that skill properly, then it may not require getting into the particulars of certain attacks. Does that make sense?
Definitely. And if you, you know, if you use AES as a cipher, it means you don't need to know every single form of cryptanalysis, but you sure better understand the ways that different modes of operation work. So mm-hmm. there are certain things that you can exclude, other things you have to worry about.
So you designed parts of SSL version 3 as a consulting project for Netscape. And at that time, processor speed was a serious constraint. And now that it isn't, would you do anything differently, or was the speed up dictated by Moore's law kind of factored into the design?
Well, you know, performance in crypto is very, very rarely a problem. I mean, there are a few massive websites that have issues, but even when we were doing the design then, absent denial of service issues against the web server, there really weren't too many concerns. You know, your web browser in those days was usually connecting through a 56 kilobit modem, but your PC CPU was more than fast enough to do crypto, so it really wasn't a significant overhead.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, I mean, a lot of attention gets paid to performance and security systems, but really what users want at the end of the day is to know that their computer isn't going to get screwed up. And if you save them a millisecond here and a millisecond there, but they end up spending an entire day rebuilding their hard drive, you haven't served anybody's purpose objectives in doing that. So in doing that design, there were some performance things that that I was paying attention to with the number of round trips. So there's a session resumption capability in mm-hmm. that protocol that can shave off a round trip. But aside from that, performance really wasn't a major concern. I don't think it is today, so long as you're using normal algorithms and using them properly.
Mm-hmm. You also designed the DES cracker. What's easier or more fun, breaking a system or designing a system that's hard to break?
They're both fun. I mean, the DES cracker project was actually as much political as technical, to show that 56-bit keys were inadequate and the export controls that were being imposed were really just causing harm for the good guys and not stopping bad guys who had any kind of a budget.
Yeah.
I'm somebody, though, where what gets me out of bed in the morning is building systems that you're going to see in the real world, that you're going to use, that are going to stop bad guys from doing things that they want to do. And a protocol like SSL, with all of its warts, and I'll be the first to admit that it has plenty of them, is really neat because it's something that people use, you know, on a daily basis. It enables people to do transactions online that you wouldn't otherwise be able to have trust in. You know, it's a neat building block, and it's used in a lot of places, and I really appreciate the opportunity to work on systems like that.
Mm-hmm. Sort of getting back to the point about the attacker perspective, I'm wondering whether you think there are complementary skills here between people who break systems and people who design systems, and whether it's rare that they're present in an individual. It certainly is the case that there are many individuals who can do this, but is it a rare thing or is it a common thing?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's some personality differences that you find in the people who really enjoy the different sorts of breaking, but in order to do design, you have to be able to deal with things like politics mm-hmm. and businesses and business constraints and contracts and managing engineering teams, whereas breaking things in most cases, and actually the deep crack system is kind of unusual, is a sort of guy in his basement, solitary individual type of a pursuit.
Yep.
And so there are big differences between the two. I'm not sure you can sort of generalize across all kinds of problems, but you know, in general, if you were to generalize, I think that the guys who design things have a much more complex set of problems in terms of actually getting their work used, getting it deployed. Whereas if you're an attacker and you post your exploit online, it's going to be used, not by the people that you want to use it. but the distribution models are very different, and the way that the results are produced is very different.
We'll be right back after this message. The landmark 50th episode of the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw is an interview with cybersecurity luminary Richard A. Clark. The episode was recorded in high-definition video and is available on the Silver Bullet website, www.sigital.com/silverbullet, as well as on YouTube. Make sure to check out the video. So we were both active in microcontroller/smart card security space in the mid-90s when you invented DPA, or differential power analysis. At that time, there were many interesting attacks lurking at the boundary between hardware and software. Has this boundary been properly investigated to your satisfaction from a security perspective?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, you can just see that when we pull products in the lab and start looking at them, we expect to find problems. And, you know, a few days have passed and we haven't found any vulnerabilities or, you know, things that let us know that we're going to break it with a little more work. We're surprised. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in many ways, the problems are getting worse here. I mean, it used to be that you'd have, you know, very small CPUs that were responsible for security, like 8051 on a microprocessor and a smart card. These days, you've got, you know, hundreds of kilobytes of code on the same kinds of chips using the same applications. So all the issues that you've traditionally been dealing with on securing PCs and big software applications are percolating and infecting the few things that we used to be able to rely on.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, a lot of the work that we're doing in my company now, if software is involved in the security at all, we view that as inherently unacceptable, and we're doing security engineering, you know, using ASIC hardware, defining the individual gates and flip-flops and logic that make up the critical pieces of the system. And it's the only way that we can build systems where we actually know that somebody isn't going to come in, for example, at some lower layer and virtualize what we're doing. Or
you heard it here first. The solution to software security is don't have any.
Exactly. Well, the solution to network security that we use in my company is effectively don't have any also. We have a separate network that's completely isolated. We don't connect it to the outside because, I mean, it's embarrassing. I run a security company and I can't figure out how to secure a network that's connected to the internet. I mean, it's too hard and too nasty a problem. So we gave up on it and we disconnected all the critical stuff. Terribly depressing.
So you sold part of your company to MakerVision for $60 million, which included the Blu-ray security design. What caused you to hit on the notion of putting protection code on the content disk itself instead of in the player?
Well, so I looked at the security of the DVD format when it first came out, and there were the obvious things everybody knew about, you know, bad algorithms, bad key sizes, and so forth. But one of the things that was immediately obvious was that the wrong people were writing the security software. you had player makers who have no interest in solving Hollywood's problem.
Right, it's not their content.
Exactly, and you know, why should I spend money to protect your house from being broken into? I mean, I might, if I'm a nice guy, do a little token effort, but I spend a lot more work on protecting my house than I do protecting my neighbor's house. Mm-hmm. And with content protection, in many ways, it's even worse than the device makers not caring. In some cases, they actually have consumers who want to pirate stuff, so they have an incentive in that case to cater to that demand and intentionally make their security bad.
Right.
So building a system where every player has unchanging static code in it that's responsible for protecting all content, past, present, and future, and you just pray that nothing will go wrong, is an absolutely ineffective and disastrous security model to use.
Mm-hmm.
So we built a system where we put security software in each disk, and that way it could be written by the studio, and it could change as attacks change, because inevitably they do, and simplified the problem for player makers because they were no longer the sole entity responsible for security.
And I got to tell you, I used to curse you with some regularity, though, Paul, because I had an early Blu-ray player that wasn't connected to the net, and so I had to reburn its BIOS pretty consistently whenever a new design came out of the studios.
Actually, that had nothing to do with the security. That had to do with the interactive component to Blu-ray, because there's a big Java layer, which is orders of magnitude more complicated than
actually. Oh, well, I take back all of that cursing, then. My bad.
No, I'm just saying you should curse somebody else, not me.
That was a pretty good idea, though, I think. And it shows kind of the way that you blend a technical approach that's very savvy and correct with this notion of a business model. And I think that that's an incredibly rare skill, which is very interesting to talk about. In addition to being a world-class engineer and designer, you're an exceptional entrepreneur. So tell us a bit about Cryptography Research's organic growth. I mean, I find it astounding that your annual revenue per employee target is $4 million, as opposed to, say, 180K or something normal. And
yeah, it's gone down as we've grown. So, I should start saying, I mean, a lot of what we've been able to do is, in many ways, just luck. I mean, I went to college just as the dot-com boom was sort of forming, and graduated just as kind of the curve was about to go ballistic. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the history of cryptography, there's been probably no more exciting period than the one that I've been fortunate enough to work in.
Mm-hmm.
And then combine that with just having the good luck to find research results that actually could ultimately generate money, and understanding the patent system well enough in order to actually get paid for that work. I mean, there's just a series of coincidences that I can look back in my life. I mean, I was supposed to become a veterinarian. That was my plan when I went off to college. So in any other decade other than the one where I did, I would be a veterinarian today. So there's a degree of being in the right place at the right time. There's also an element of looking at research and being able to find things where you meet a whole bunch of different constraints at once. I mean, it needs to be an interesting problem to keep myself and the others here engaged with it. It needs to be something where there's a technical element. There needs to be a business case that works. It can't have political problems associated with it. I mean, there are a million great security things you could do if you could just, you know, restart the clock and build things properly from scratch, but you can never do that. So you have to have a way to evolve into or take what you produce and actually get people to adopt it, given the world the way it is today. And one of the frustrating things is you keep finding work in the lab that, you know, doesn't meet all of those constraints, mm-hmm. and you have to look at this really nice, attractive, you know, shiny result and say, okay, it's going to put you on the shelf, and I'm going to keep looking for the next one. Security is a difficult place to make money because you've got a lot of engineers who don't understand what they don't know, and that sounds like a double negative, but it's actually not really. I mean, if you don't understand how things can go wrong, you don't value or even understand what somebody's going to do to try to fix them.
Mm-hmm.
You've got entrenched interests that often, you know, don't want to use somebody else's security technology. I mean, everybody wants to manage the keys themselves, yet almost nobody is actually competent to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the same thing with design. So it's a tough area to work. But when you do find something that's important, people do deploy it, and people really do want security. It's just a question of building technology that works properly.
So tell us a little bit about the philosophy that drives Cryptography Research and how you've grown over the years and how you attract good people?
Well, hiring is actually by far our biggest problem. And I mean, there are three main things that I look for in people that we hire. I mean, one is this person technically, at least for technologists, technically brilliant? And many times you know, but sometimes it's actually hard to tease that out in an interview. Or maybe you know the work that somebody's done. And then somebody has to be fun to work with, just because life's too short to spend time working with people that aren't fun. And then somebody has to communicate well.
Yep.
Because security, to a large degree, especially the design side, is about communication. If you are the mad genius who comes up with something nobody can understand, that's completely useless on the design side, because you have to show your customer why it's secure, you have to show their customers why it's secure, you have to deal with multiple companies if it's going to be a standard. You have to make sure that you've made correct assumptions about lower layers of abstraction, and the people who are using what you build understand what you've produced, or you'll have security failures. So communication skills are the third thing that's really important.
Mm-hmm. So the real challenge is finding an individual that has all three of those skills.
Absolutely. If you only needed two, it would be much easier to find people.
And so with regard to trying to grow, you've always been fairly conservative, I guess. And in the end, it's really paid off very handsomely. Do you think that that's just timing, like you were talking about before? Or do you think that that is a business model that, to be contrasted with, say, venture capital-driven companies, is something that's really worth thinking more carefully about?
We've left a lot of... By growing slowly, there are a lot of projects we've not pursued, and probably some of them would have paid off if we had pursued them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at it from two directions. One, you can say, look, you're doing great for the size that you are. You can also look at it from the perspective of saying, well, if you'd stuck the gas pedal to the floor, you could be much bigger than you are.
Mm-hmm.
You can argue it either way. Having been through the most recent recession and also the dot-com crash and navigated a company through that, having a company where you've grown to be exactly the optimal size given your optimistic market projections is a pretty scary thing, whereas if you've got a company where you're turning down projects, you're pursuing the third or quarter of the opportunities that come along that look most attractive.
Yep.
If a recession comes along, okay, maybe that ratio goes up a bit, but it's a much more stable and more less stressful way to manage a group.
More headroom. Plus, as you said before, interesting work is really the key. That's a lot more, there's more reward in some senses doing interesting work than there may be just monetarily. It's not about piling
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not somebody who wakes up in the morning and says, okay, how can I make enough money to buy X thing? I mean, I reached the point where I could eat out every night, and there's not really a lot more I can eat, and there's not that much that I really want to buy that I would actually bring me happiness or anything. So it's really more a question of, do I have the problems I want? Am I working with people that I enjoy working with?
Uh-huh.
Am I making a difference in terms of stopping bad guys, helping people protect their data? I mean, those are the things that get me out of bed in the morning and make me love going into work and working on these kinds of systems.
Mm-hmm. So now a really easy one. Does P equal NP?
If N equals 1, it does.
That's a cheating answer. that N doesn't equal 1.
I intuitively have a conviction that the answer is no. I would be delighted to be shown wrong, but of the things that I lie awake at night, fundamental mathematical breakthroughs are way at the bottom of the list, along with quantum computing and stuff.
Yeah.
Software bugs, implementation defects, operator errors, bad user interfaces, misuse of algorithms, malicious guys in manufacturing facilities. These are the things that you lie awake worrying about. And if you quantify the risks, the likelihood that some incredible mathematical breakthrough is going to cause all of our ciphers to collapse is really infinitesimally small, whereas the likelihood that there are implementation defects in a broad range of products is a simple fact that we know is true, and it's just a question of trying to find them and cope with them and deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I couldn't agree
more. It's a
great
question, but if anybody's laying awake at night worried that somebody's going to break AES-256 and not worried about the quality of their hardware and software implementations or side channel attacks and so forth. They've completely missed the boat.
That's true. But, you know, you did wax philosophical. I was just hoping for a yes or a no.
Okay. Well, when you interview cryptographers, you know better than to expect a yes or no answer.
We'll leave that for next episode. And then last question of all, and really the most important, what is your favorite breakfast cereal?
You know, I don't actually get breakfast most mornings. It's horrible.
No cereal.
Better answer to that. No cereal
at all. That's fine. Some people like surprising things. I think we had somebody on one episode who liked Fruit Loops the best. All right, thanks.
What's your favorite breakfast cereal?
My favorite breakfast cereal?
Yeah.
No. Corn Chex.
Corn Chex. Okay, well, I'll give that a try next time I make breakfast. I was expecting to have something like bacon and ice cream.
Yeah, well, we haven't mentioned that in public for quite a long time now, Paul.
Some things are best kept private.
Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The June-July issue of IEEE S&P digs into data privacy. With corporations collecting and collating so much data, how does privacy stand a chance? Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.